of our own. Of course, we want you guys to join the conversation. That's what this show is about, a larger conversation amongst our community about love and the issues we just generally don't talk about with each other. So if you've got something to say, give us a call, 895-1114, or you can also reach us on the Facebook page. Sometimes it's a little bit more challenging, just FYI, but you're welcome to try that route if you do not want to give us a call, though we want you to give us a call.
Call us.
Please call.
See, they're making their cries. Julian, would you mind introing the song for us?
Sure. Is it Passenger? Sure is. All right, we've all heard this song a lot over the past couple years. And a lot of us have been involved in breakups and get-togethers in the past couple years, so I think this song means a lot of things to a lot of people.
Well put.
Well, you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go. Glass, hoping one day you'll make a dream last. But dreams come slow and they go so fast. You see it when you close your eyes. Maybe one day you'll understand why everything you touch surely dies. But you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. Staring at the ceiling in the dark. Same old empty feeling in your heart. Cause love comes slow and it goes so fast. Well, you see her when you fall asleep, but never to touch and never to keep. Cause you loved her too much and you dive too deep. Well, you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go.
Love in the 21st Century is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by the Downtown Chico Business Association, supporting downtown businesses for 40 years. The Friday night concerts have begun. Some of the area's best musicians and bands will be starting at 7 p.m. every Friday till September 17th. For a list of performers and for more information on upcoming events, including the picnic on the plaza, as well as how you can support the efforts of DCBA, visit downtownchico.com.
Cause you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go.
and you let her go.
All right, you let her go. So sad. So sad. Okay. So Love and Divorce.
You know
what we're
really
talking about.
Her.
I hope that this is not what this show is going to be about, really something sad. I hope it's going to be about growing and possibilities and all the success that comes through making good positive choices for your life for the ones that you love. So we wanted to start you off with something that gets you in the sentimental mood, in the mood to discuss something that's, you know, slightly serious for many people out there, kind of serious, really serious. And that's what we're going to be doing. So Miss Emily Rose, will you do our introduction?
Yeah, here we have Lee Stockwell with us today. And say hi, Lee.
Hello.
I met Lee through his ex-wife, Brooke. I was girlfriends with Brooke for quite a while, and she ended up going through my coaching program and recommended Lee too as well. And so Lee's been through my coaching program as well. And through that process, I had written a book and things like that. And he had already written his first draft of a book on a topic that he was very well versed in, which is basically amicable divorce, or as the book was first titled, Divorce Without Drama, and it is now titled Diplomatic Divorce, and you can find that on Amazon. Just look up Diplomatic Divorce. But it's very exciting to have Lee in here with us today, because Lee and Brooke have just set, they are the role models for the shining examples of how to amicably go through the process of divorce, which may not be amicable at first, which I'm sure we'll hear about, but, you know, to work on that for the sake of the kids and become friends, you know, through that process. And I know that they have really been role models for a lot of groups of friends of theirs, and enough so that finally Lee was like, all right, let me write a book about this thing.
Right. Yeah. Initially, it came about because somebody at a birthday party for my son mentioned that we got along really well, and they were noticing that. Like, how do you do that? You guys should teach a class or something. I thought, well, I don't know if I could teach a class yet, but maybe a book would be a better way to go about it, because, you know, it'd be a little bit less threatening. You'd be on your own reading it, maybe help you a little bit, and then from there, maybe we'll see. Someday, maybe there will be a class.
Yeah, and I know that this book turned out to be an incredible, it covers all the basics of what you might go through from start to finish with your internal processing around divorce. It's really good.
So, diplomatic divorce. What, you know, amicable, that you're using that word too. What do you mean? What does that mean to be in a diplomatic divorce or an amicable divorce?
Well, in the book, I focus a lot on marriages with kids, and I know not every marriage is going to have kids and end in divorce, but for me, that was the main motivator for how things ended up turning out, because the kids were important to both of us, and so it was basically the motivation that caused us to be initially diplomatic, and now we're good friends. So not everybody's going to have the kind of relationship that Brooke and I have, but I believe it is possible for everybody to be on good, friendly terms, especially for the kids' sake.
Absolutely.
And that's what the book is really about.
So is it like taking kind of the emotion out of it in order to get to a more sound ground until you can then reintegrate?
It's about setting that intention early on, and then working towards that. It's not going to be easy for a lot of us. It wasn't for me. From the very beginning, I was angry and hurt, and you know, the way things happened, it wasn't ideal from an emotional standpoint for me to even want to be friends or even have anything to do with her. But she projected that idea early on, and said that we would still be a family. We would always be a family. And that was a foreign idea to me at the time. Now it is something that I hold very dear. And we, you know, we even celebrate certain holidays together if we happen to all be in, you know, the same town. So,
And you went to Disneyland together.
Yeah, we did a long time ago. And that was a lot of fun. It probably worked out a lot better in this situation than had we been married still.
So could you paint a picture for some of our listeners of what your relationship was prior to your divorce? Like, you know, how many kids are you talking about? How long were you together? That kind of stuff. So, I mean, for people that are listening, were you married for like 3 months? You know, I don't know. Right. I don't know you at all. So
Yeah. We were married for 7 years, and we had two beautiful children. And like I said, they're very important to us, and doing them any harm is the last thing we ever wanted to do. So that made probably this a little easier for us. However, you do see a lot of marriages end in divorce, and they don't take their kids into account, unfortunately. But I think in the book I mentioned that the marriage was probably doomed from the beginning, just from, you know, both of our places in life and our mindsets at the time, getting married for the wrong reasons probably, and so it was something that just wasn't the right fit, but that doesn't mean that we can't still get along and be friends now, and I think we're better friends now than we were then.
How long did it take you to kind of get to a more peaceful place in your relationship?
Probably took a couple of years from the beginning. Like I said, in the beginning, I was hurt and angry, and I didn't, if it weren't for the kids, I would have probably done everything I could to just wash my hands of the whole thing and pretend that she never existed. But I realized that that's not the healthy thing to do. And I'm glad that because of the kids, I was forced to face things and face my feelings and face the hurt and the anger and sit with it and deal with it. And then, basically move on and forgive. And that's, you know, what it boils down to is forgive, you know, let the water flow under the bridge and move forward together, because you have to be partners for the rest of your life, like it or not. So
it sounds like you did a lot of internal processing to get to that place.
I did. In my book, I do recommend that people, you know, seek counseling, any outside help, not to stay in sort of the victim mode of divorce or whatever caused the divorce in the first place. Just living in your hurt and your anger, it's not a place that really promotes well-being in general for anybody. And so, you know, the best thing you can do, just from a totally selfish point of view, is to create this healthy environment, to move forward and forgive and forget and move forward in with your life and let them move on with their lives.
It kind of touches on that word selfish again that I feel like we are kind of reclaiming on this show in a positive light, right?
Absolutely. Taking care of yourself is, you know, often seen as being selfish. And so,
which has a negative connotation.
Right.
We can reorient that.
What about self?
Full of yourself.
Like helpful and selfish combined into selfful. Anyway.
Yes, we are selfful.
I think it's about knowing yourself first. You can be selfish, but to the degree, you know, of your own personal awareness. You know, when you start to extend your selfishness past your own awareness, that's when it, you know, that's the whole pride cometh before a fall, kind of thing. What did you do in researching your book, Lee, in regards to like statistical or analytical research on divorce across the nation, things like that? I mean, how often do you think divorced couples maintain a friendship?
Yeah, I didn't do, honestly, a lot of research on those aspects. I basically went mostly on my personal experience. That's where the book kind of comes from. And most of the information in the book is my advice based on that personal experience. I know there are tons of statistics out there. I mean, we hear that number 50% of marriages end in divorce. That's first marriages, mm-hmm. You know, and it gets worse, you know, the more times you get married. So, you know, you're going to be a serial married person, whatever you call that.
I worked side by side with a guy for 7-8 years who was married and divorced 6 times.
Yeah.
6 times. And he said his defense, he's in his mid-60s, his defense of that, now he lives alone and is never going to date again, But he said, you know, basically, when he grew up, when you fell in love, you got married. Like, that's what you do. And he was just so, like, raised under that tradition that he, you know, he fell in love 6 times. When you think about it, 60 years of life, it's possible to fall in love 6 times, absolutely, you know? And but if you marry every single one and divorce every single one, that's the serial marriage stuff. But again, under his training, that's what you did. So, like, how do you feel, you know, at marriage as a concept? Do you feel it's going to be around a long time? Is it in its dying days?
Julian says it's in its dying days.
Yeah, you know, I'm seeing a future not too far from now where life expectancy is extended so far that people intentionally sign like 10-year contracts, you know, like to be married like in segments of time, just because people are living so much longer. The rest of your life is a lot longer than it used to be.
To be discontinued.
To be discontinued, exactly.
Yeah, that question does come up a lot, I think, in this discussion. And I don't have the answer to that. I'm still on the fence myself as far as me personally. How do I feel about remarriage? You know, I guess for me right now, it depends on the person that I'm with and what their values are and how they mesh with mine and, you know, the conversation that we have together about how we feel about it. I would like to think that I could be faithful to one person the rest of my life, but I mean, so far it hasn't worked that way, so I don't know.
You know, how do I phrase this? What have you found to be kind of the biggest deterrent for new relationships in this family friendship way of relating to your ex?
That's a good question. You've obviously very familiar with my life and the book already. Brings up an interesting point. A lot of my relationships, I should say all, have had to some degree or another had some form of a problem with it. Been threatened by our situation, and I've had to examine myself a little bit in that, and wonder, you know, am I projecting sort of a sense that that door is still open for us, that maybe there are still feelings for each other that are, you know, that haven't really been fully talked about or realized. And you know, had this fairly recently, you know, I finally came to that conclusion. We had the talk, Brooke and I, and we said, no, it's done. That's it. So it's very clear for us now, and maybe it wasn't in the past. But the issue has been that because we are close, you know, we're good friends, we support each other. You know, we spend, like you said, we went to Disneyland with the kids, and that was totally platonic. No romance whatsoever. It was a lot of fun. We all had fun, the kids, we as adults, as older kids, had fun at Disneyland. And, you know, so we do stuff like that. And some people, that's just outside of the realm of their experience.
Yeah, well, I can see from, you know, somebody who's coming into your life to be dated and potentially in a long-term relationship with, how that might be challenging. I can actually see both sides of it where, you know, the person coming in is going to have a certain level of self-awareness and respect and understanding around your situation so that there isn't any jealousy or feelings of threat. But at the same time, there's that... I could also see where it would be difficult since yours and Brooke's relationship is although you're no longer married, it's still a primary familial relationship. So there is a certain level of priority to that over maybe a new budding relationship, you know?
I would say the priority though is in the fact of your children, right? Because like what he mentioned at the beginning of the show is the reason he sustained that relationship and really had the strong desire to do so was to support his children, which, you know, I think any loving partner or budding relationship would find that as a respectable, desirable trait from somebody.
I actually brought this up for a reason.
You, I know you.
Nuh-uh.
I wanted to open the conversation around this.
Hey, like, this is good.
You know? Yeah. How would you guys feel, you know, stepping into that?
Well, I can say that I personally have been told by women in the past that if I had a child, they wouldn't date me.
I was one of those women, not you, but you know what
because,
I mean.
Because it was their perspective, there will always be another woman in a man's life whenever that there's a child involved.
That's interesting. And they're
not into sharing space.
If you want to join this conversation, give us a call, 895-1114. I would say that I have said that in the past, not because of another woman, though. It's more because of responsibility.
I'm right there with you, Tony.
I'm like, I don't know if I can commit to that much responsibility in life for myself, let alone for somebody else that's having to do that for a child. If I wanted to do that as a woman, then I would have maybe pursued that road. And so that was my point in the past. But the whole jealousy thing and, you know, time and commitment that you're bringing up, I would think the level of awareness that you're talking about, Emily, is, you know, is necessary for somebody to be willing to participate in that. But also, you know, kudos to you for doing that, because your kids are the most important thing, and it's a good thing to realize that, yeah, you made that agreement for the rest of your life when you had those kids, not necessarily when you made those vows. But when you had those kids, like, whether you liked it or not, like, for anybody that's out there having kids that aren't married, it's the same agreement. Like, mm-hmm. You maybe should have thought a little bit harder about who you're taking home. When it comes down to it. So.
Oh, man.
Oh,
judgment flying from
judgment
love
on the love
century.
Of the 21st century. Yeah. Hey, this you is know, just my opinion.
on the other end of the other side of the coin, I guess. I have only dated one person in my life who had children, and she had two little boys, and we, you know, full-on dated, traveled around the country, whole deal. I potty trained her sons, and now they're high school, like, graduates and stuff.
So they call
you
dad?
Very strange. Not at all. Not at all. but that was, you know, I was 18, 19 at the time, and after that, for me personally, like, the breakup with the kids was just, you know, just as rough, and the whole deal, and just like, I've intentionally, personally steered clear of that.
Yeah,
since.
That brings up a good segue to the conversation, though, about dating with children.
Yeah.
And, like, when you allow people to be around your children, and, like, how that kind of, what your experience has been, if you've had that experience of, like, for either you or your ex-wife.
Yeah, what's really cool too is I think that a lot of how the kids are going to respond to that depends a lot on the parents and the relationship between the parents and the children, and kind of the understanding around the children. How have your kids dealt with that, Lee?
They've been really relaxed about it. I know a lot of people, they get really freaked out about, you know, introducing their kids to someone that they're dating. We really haven't. I mean, we take precautions and we're careful, but we're not. The kids are aware that we're dating. We're not hiding that from them, and they know this. And they're really secure in their relationship to us. They don't feel threatened by anyone new coming into the relationship, which I think may be part of the fear that a lot of parents are dealing with, that their kids will be upset. I know I dated one lady with a son who. He was threatened by, you know, a new relationship, but it was a pretty fresh situation. He hadn't had a chance to really adjust to the idea of his parents being split up either. So, in general, I think our kids handle it really well.
It seems like your guys' relationship and the stability there would lend.
Yeah, exactly.
Feeling more stable.
I think that's kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah, that's really cool.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe a volatile breakup relationship. It would be scarier to have new people come in because it's like everything's already unstable on unstable grounds.
And that also underlines the whole point of my book again, you know, just getting back to why it's the benefits of being in a diplomatic divorce situation. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to get divorced, why not make it friendly and, you know, amicable, easier to deal with, less stress, less drama.
Maybe it's just me, but the reason I brought up, like, putting the emotions, like, shelving the emotions at first or whatever is because of the word diplomatic. Like, to me, it sort of seems like pragmatic, like, sort of getting more down to, the business of it and less, you know, the emotions of it. Maybe I'm totally misinterpreting that.
But no, that's accurate, I think, because you do have to set aside your emotions at first. I mean, you're human. You're going to be... in whatever, you know, emotional state that you're in. If the divorce starts out being, you know, say somebody was unfaithful and you can't be in that relationship anymore, you know, walk away. There are all kinds of, I'm sure, negative feelings that people would attribute to that, and you're stuck in that. So, you know, how do you navigate those feelings and still keep things on a civil basis? And that's where, you know, being diplomatic maybe in the beginning has to take place.
So if you're just tuning in, we are talking with Lee Stockwell about love and divorce, especially when children are involved. And he recently wrote a book entitled Diplomatic Divorce. And it's available on Amazon if you're tuning in and are interested in purchasing the book. But we're going to continue our conversation here in a minute. We're maybe getting to some tactics, some tips for you folks out there that maybe be experiencing it, or know somebody that's experiencing it, or maybe just are thinking about it. So, yeah, we'll be getting to that here shortly.
Even the word greed is not negative enough to characterize the all-out assault on workers by today's corporate elite. From offshoring jobs to busting unions, from slashing wages to looting pensions, corporate takeaways from America's used-to-be middle-class workforce certainly are driven by the avarice of top executives and wealthy investors. Plainly put, the more they can take from workers, the more they can put in their own pockets, or most likely in their offshore bank accounts. It adds up to a massive redistribution of wealth from the many to the few. In addition to greedy, though, these people are rank thieves. As Woody Guthrie succinctly put it, some will rob you with a six-gun, some with a fountain pen. We're now in a rapacious fountain pen economy. Since the Wall Street crash of 2008, itself a product of grand theft by financial elites, the productivity and creativity of all Americans have regenerated every bit of the wealth that was frittered away by bankers, and we created trillions of dollars in new income. What a phenomenal national achievement that is, produced in an astonishingly short time by the shared effort of our people. But strenuous effort is all we shared. The richest 1% of Americans have grabbed 91% of the gains in income, and the even richer 0.1% sucked up 22% of the new wealth. Thus, the vast majority of us have still not recovered the wealth we lost, homes, cars, savings, etc., and 99% of us are getting less income today than we were before Wall Street crashed our economy 7 years ago. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's time we robbies started talking plainly about what's going on. The rich are not getting richer because they're more enterprising than everyone else, harder working, or of stronger moral character. They're thieves, and they're getting richer by stealing from you.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
It's always interesting around here on our breaks, just so you guys know. The conversation never really ends, but we're going to continue the best we can from where we left off. Anybody want to jump in?
I think where we left off in private conversation.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
While Jim Hightower was playing,
was
about commitment, and I believe Emily asked.
I asked, if one ends up, breaking up at some point in a committed relationship, were you really ever truly committed, or does the early termination of the commitment or the temporary nature of the commitment defy the actual definition of the word commitment in the first place?
Right. My gut response, initial response to that is that it depends on what you're committing to and the duration of said commitment. If there's an agreed upon term limit, then fine. If you fulfill so many years in the military that you signed up to, then you've fulfilled that commitment to the military.
But that's in the contract, like you said before.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
The commitment is limited. What if the marriage was the contract?
But marriage is the contract. So no, it wasn't. You know, that's what you sign up for. That's the deal with the marriage. If you don't want that, you don't have to have that.
Don't say that part.
Nobody's forcing marriage on anybody. In fact, there are some people struggling to get married in this country.
Oh,
so,
right.
So as there's the marriage strike happening in the heterosexual sector, there's the marriage push happening in the LG. T-Q-Z. Yeah. Anyway, so, and th- but then
what
again,
a paradox.
But then when it comes to like dating, though, you know, somebody, you know, says, you know, like, oh yeah, let's be committed, let's be monogamous, and then 2 weeks later is like, nope, screw that. Then you feel like, okay, they were never really committed in the first place, you know? So it, it gets vague. At what point, you know, a year, 2 months, 3 months, you know, I feel like getting back to the seasonal discussion we were having earlier, that if you pull through a full season with somebody, you can say at least you were committed for that season.
That season.
3 months.
In case anybody's forgotten, the season is 3 months long. Yeah, the evolution of relationships, you know, it's hard to say because we evolve so constantly as people that to say that somebody wasn't committed at one point in the relationship, I mean, obviously they were fully present, hopefully, in that moment. But I feel like, you know, what Lee referenced a little bit earlier about, you know, their age when they got married and like their awareness about life and the things that where you don't really set people up for, you know, the youth that are growing up, like the real like reality of knowing yourself and knowing what you want before you go looking out there for somebody else or something else or a job or school or to fulfill it is not like it's a new concept. Imagine that, like people are now teaching their kids like, no, like figure out what you want, like what you really want, not just something that's gonna like pay your rent, because that's really what is gonna sustain you through life. We have a lot of people like our generation and, you know, and beyond that are living in the idea that the marriage was the end all. You know, you went to school, maybe you didn't go to school, and then you ended up getting married. So they were committed the best they could at that time, but people evolve. So is it like loving what we beginning of the show, the, you know, love and let her go sort of thing. It's like sad and melodramatic, but it's like, you know, the long adage of like loving and letting it go. If you really love something, let it go. Like let that person truly become who they really are intended to be. And that's like, is it really about the love or is it about the contract? Is it about the marriage? Like, is it the social contract that we were talking about during the break?
I'd like to also add.
Sorry,
that's
guys.
That's not what I was trying to add. Sorry if that hurt your ears, audience. What I was going to add is that in a world where people are having less and less of a career that lasts their entire adult life, that if your career is going to be constantly changing, it might be, what's the word? You might find yourself interacting with many individuals of your interested partner gender. Mm-hmm. And
like that, your scene is changing a lot and you're meeting
so if
a lot
your
of
scene's
new
changing
people
a lot,
are,
it might not be good to commit too soon or too much.
Because you're going to be meeting a lot of really cool people in all the things that you do.
No.
So stay free.
Theoretically, stay free.
So we're good. Encouraging you all to stay free.
Not get married.
You started that off with, in a world.
Yeah.
But I was also talking about career-oriented things. So.
Right, so...
Well, that is another thing. Stuff I've read about the marriage strike. How people are getting, you know, fewer and fewer people are getting married at younger ages. Is that's... The number one kind of struggle for relationships is what's called the myth of opportunity. And there are people kind of... go, well, why am I going to be with this person when there's 3 billion other people in this world I'm qualified to be with?
What is it about this
one? You know, or whatever. It's like, exactly, and there's this thought due to social media and things like that, and, you know, on internet dating and things of that nature, where it's just like swipe, 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 swipe.
Tinder.
Exactly. There's the...
We need to do a show on Tinder, because I have no idea what this is.
Yeah. Oh.
Anyway, moving on.
Anyway, it's that myth of opportunity.
Right.
You know, when we did the show on internet dating before, we talked about, I think Mark brought up how, you know, when you sign up for that kind of thing, you start looking at all the profiles, you're so easily dismissive of an entire human being. Because you're like, oh, nope, you have a cat. Next. Oh, nope, you have a dog. Nope. Next. Oh, wait. You know, you're not self-employed. You are self-employed. You're this, you're that. And it's just like, with all the information right there, you know, people kind of push that through and they forget that real relationship is about connection and, you know, understanding of one another and emotional compatibility and things of that nature.
But it's also meeting on those big things.
And sure, it is absolutely meeting on those big things, and that's necessary, but...
Like, if you don't like my cat, that's not going to happen.
Right. I got two cats. Right. If you don't like that,
yeah,
it's the door.
There are certain standards, but the thing is, it causes... I think the myth of opportunity causes people to be almost too picky. I mean, it's good to be picky, and one could argue there's no such thing as too picky, you know. However, you know, you got to open yourself up to new love and new experiences in life, and, you know, sometimes that can be challenging, and the myth of opportunity can seem really exciting.
And sometimes the things that you so desire are not necessarily things that are so important as time goes on. Maybe you actually do love cats, and you didn't know that until you met this person who has a cat, and you're like, wow, this cat is amazing. Like, you know, these things are evolving and changing. We set prototypes and, like, specific decisions in our life about what we want and what we want to create, but we don't always know all the things that we want. We know our preferences, and sometimes we learn our preferences through our experiences, what we do not want and what we do want. But going back to that conversation about commitment and understanding, like, really... like where your flexibilities lie and where your like firm lines are, and being able to have those conversations before you do. Like if you have allergies to cats, now that's a little different. Like, you know, like where is it that you have a firm boundary versus just kind of flexible decision making?
Yeah. I think as far as the conversation about commitment goes, you know, I don't know. I want to go back to what Julian was saying about like the length of commitment. I feel like, you know, when you're talking about contracts like that, I mean, marriage is a contract. And so, you know, what does that say about...
Whose contract, though?
I know, right? And what is that... is it a... People focus when they get married, they focus on making all of these commitments to this other person, but really you can never make a commitment to another, you're making it to yourself. And so in those moments while you're standing there, you know, professing whatever you're professing in front of some person who can marry you, you know, you're thinking that you're sharing this information with this other person and saying it to them and expressing it to them and investing it in them. But really, I think that you're saying it to yourself. And if you're not saying it to yourself, then you actually run the risk of kind of going down the path of divorce, because otherwise you're looking for fulfillment from this other person and not from yourself. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of the myths that's out there. You know, I would kind of blame Disney for a lot of that, you know, the happily ever after, you know, fairy tale that we all seem to be trained for in this country, you know, from an early age. Well, you meet the one person that's going to make you happy for the rest of your life, and you quickly find out that this person has no capacity to make you happy, and you have to do that yourself. That comes from within you, and that's one of the things I had to learn after my divorce, unfortunately.
Yeah, where's the Disney movie that's showing you, like, grow up and, like, follow your own dreams, like mm-hmm. in The Alchemist, just doing what you want, not looking for somebody else to fulfill your dreams. I mean, it's true. Like, how many movies, TV shows, radio songs are, you know, programming mm-hmm. people to believe that, like, all you got to find is that love that's so fulfilling. It's part of the reason we have this show is to help people understand that there's more to love than just loving one other person. There's hundreds of thousands of millions of billions of people on this planet that need love, and there's plants that need love, and there's communities that need love, and there's passions and drive. So, like, what about all that stuff? Like, we invest all of our energy in this one person that's supposed to show up on, you know, shiny. And
I think that's part of the deal, is people look at it as finding the one, and it should be more about finding that partnership. It shouldn't be about finding that one person who's going to finish it off for you, or that one person you really connect. It's got to, you're looking for that, you know, that something that's greater than the sum of its parts. You want something new and exciting created by a coupling with somebody. And I think that's the deal. And I do personally believe that we're meant to go through this life in pairs, at least.
So,
at least in caveat.
But, you know, I think that life as a human being, biologically, etc., emotionally, is just you know, and maybe your partner is going to change so many times in your life. But there's this drive, not always to, you know, seek fulfillment from another human being, but just to do something together with somebody. You know, like, that's a really powerful thing. And I think, you know, it's hard to find.
So, Lee, do you have any tips for our listeners, like what it was like maybe in the beginning of your separation? Like, what are some just like simple, taking a step back observation from your situation that you could share with somebody that's maybe in a similar situation without going out and buying your book right this moment?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, when you get into that situation, like I said, we talked about earlier being diplomatic. You want to, first of all, express that intention of being on friendly terms from the beginning, and talk to the other, to your, you know, soon-to-be former partner about this, or I guess you could say forever partner. You want to express that and talk about it as much as they're willing to go there with you. But overall, that commitment has to be your commitment. And the other person has to make it their commitment. You can't force it. So, you know, express that commitment up front and then do everything that you can to show your commitment to that and be sincere in that commitment. And then, you know, from there you go into the discussions of logistics. How's this going to look? Where do we start? You start dividing up your property and your things and how, who gets the kids when and all this stuff. And in my book, I talk about, you know, being fair. And you know what's fair. You know what you have. You know, whose is whose and what's what. And, you know, don't try to take stuff from somebody else. It's not yours. And that just causes contention. And, you know, you want to fight for friendship, and that all of that stuff just, you know, undermines that intention. So, you know, those main things. And then one of the key things that I think is important is don't rush out and get a lawyer right away. Sit with each other and talk about it, you know, what's going to happen and who gets what and everything, without involving lawyers. And if you find that you can't be civil and friendly in that moment, take a step back and, you know, calm down, cool off, and then come back together when you're more rational and talk about it again.
Do you actually need a lawyer to get divorced? I mean, I
you don't.
That's a real question.
Okay. You don't. But I did. But we agreed to share the same lawyer. And that's one of the points I make. If you get a lawyer, it does make it a lot easier. I tried filing for divorce on my own about 3 times, and they kept sending me the paperwork back because, you know, bureaucracy, there's always something you miss, you know, so this form, AZ123 or something, and you got to go back and fill it out and then send it all in again. So the lawyer can cut through all of that.
It almost seems like, I remember a point in your book that that you repeated a few times or something along the lines of, like, don't take it personally. It's that lesson of not taking what they're doing
right.
Personally. And it almost seems like if you involve a third party, that it's easier to, like, not take something personally because it's not coming directly from the person that you're with.
Yeah. When you talk about a mediator, too, that's another alternative to a lawyer. And, you know, the mediator can just sit there and listen to both of you equally, and then they can, you know, objectively, for the most part, say, this is half, this is half. You know, this keeps you, you know, financially secure. This keeps you financially secure. This is fair. And then, you know, everybody walks away from the table feeling like, okay, I can agree to that. And then you sign those papers, and it's, you know, it's legally binding. So, and I also recommend having a what's called a marital separation agreement, or MSA, written up, preferably by a lawyer. Because that gives you something to refer back to. And we've had to refer back to it over the years because there's things that you just forget that you agreed to. You know, there's so much stuff. And you go through and you think, oh, wait, wasn't I supposed to get this? Or wasn't this supposed to happen here or whatever? And you can just flip through that and go, yep, it says so right here. And you can just point it out, and you don't have to be, you know, it saved us, I think, from a lot of potential arguments. Or, you know, it's solved some arguments that have started out, and we've gone, okay, well, this says here, and I agreed to honor that, so that's what I'm going to do.
Can you give us an example of something that it would be in that agreement?
In my personal one or just in general?
Whichever you feel comfortable with.
Well, yeah, since Brooke isn't here, maybe I'll just keep it to generals. she can, I don't want to make her uncomfortable.
You're like, I get the dog.
Yeah. No, it was, there are things about, personal property, you know, who gets what. And that's always a point of contention. And monetary compensation, things like, what alimony or no alimony, child support or no child support, that kind of thing is contained in the marital separation agreement. And also, child custody agreements can vary from divorce to divorce depending on the situation. Hopefully it's 50-50 and both parents want them equally, but in some cases, unfortunately, that's not true. So that's also spelled out in something like that. It basically iterates every single possible scenario that could potentially come up and gives you an outcome for that so that you don't have to, fight about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about the co-parenting, how that works, like how, what it's like in terms of your relationship with your children. Like, do you, it happens in normal households where one kid asks one parent something and then they go to the other parent and they're like, I didn't ask them that at all, or they totally told me I could do that. And so I'm wondering, like, how that with your co-parenting is affected with your children and in general.
Do they still work, both of you?
They don't really. I think they've seen that we present a united front still, which I think is key in marriage or in divorce. You can't let your kids play one against the other. And kids naturally just do that. They want to get their way, of course, but they're looking for structure and boundaries. And the way they do that is by testing them. Can I go here? Nope. Okay. Can I go here? Nope. Okay. So they know where they're safe. And as parents, Brooke and I both, it speaks to communication. We are okay with each other. We're friends, so we can talk. And that's a very important component of parenting. We talk about things. If something comes up, we get together and talk about it, or talk about it on the phone or text or whatever, and clear it up. And so there's never really, at this point, there hasn't been any opportunity where the kids can say, well, Mom said this, or Dad said that, and it's not like we're not checking up on it. We're saying, well, did you say this? Okay. So then but for the most part, our parenting styles in our particular situation are very similar. So, there's usually not much of that anyway.
Right, which is probably something that is an advantage to other parents that are out there that might have very different parenting styles or have different lifestyles or different dietary styles. All those things come into factor when you're raising kids, like what time they go to bed, what they eat, are they allowed to stay the night at friends' houses, and so the communication that you're bringing up is a really important component. Like, if you weren't as easily just to pick up the phone and ask, call your former partner, your forever partner, then how would that end up? I think a lot of arguments.
Well, you also have to learn to let go. You can't control what happens in that other household. Your kids are your kids, and they're your responsibility, sure. But you have to accept that the other parent has their best interests in mind as well. And just because they parent a little bit differently maybe at the other house doesn't mean that that's wrong or bad. And you have to accept that you can't control what happens over there. You are only in control of what happens in your household, and to try to assume more than that is where you get into trouble.
Mm. Absolutely. That's such really a beautiful thing to say. Yeah. That really, you both, or all that are really involved, have the best interest of the child at heart. And so really coming from that state of mind instead of like, they're not doing it my way, or that we already talked about that, but just being like, okay, things happen, sometimes you get Slurpees at 11 o'clock at night.
I like that expression. How did you put it? A united front?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Okay.
Do you think anybody under the age of 25 should be getting married at all?
Absolutely not.
Nope.
I would say 30 minimum.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
that's, be in love, have kids, do everything you want, just don't.
Yeah, I mean, I would even say hold off on all that stuff until you're 30, because what do you know until you're 30? I didn't know anything, you know?
You think you know a lot.
Well, I
wish I knew everything I thought I knew then.
Yeah. That harkens back to something I brought up on the show quite a few times, a short story I loved back in the day called A Tree, A Rock, A Cloud, and it was basically about an older man telling a young boy that men go about loving backwards, that they start by trying to learn how to love the most complicated and challenging of all creatures, a woman. And to be at that level takes a lifetime of practice of loving. And so when you learn to love things like a spoon, a tree, a rock, a cloud, the simple things, then you're a little bit more prepared to love and engage with another human being. That's why I asked the 25, you know, question. Because, I think anybody under 25 getting married. I mean, I know you're listening.
Yep.
Good luck at your wedding tomorrow, under 25. But good luck. That's all I got to say.
So we are talking with Lee Stockwell, and we've been discussing his book, Diplomatic Divorce, Separation Success Without Leaving a Mess. And that is a book that you can find on Amazon. I'm looking at it right now. Lee is also the owner of Holiday Pool. So if you want to talk to him in person, you can call him up, work on your pool.
No, go down and buy a hot tub.
Or, yeah, go there down. There you go. There you go. Go down. Even better, buy a hot tub. Hot tub. Yeah. Maybe that will soothe your relationship or create a new relationship for you.
Hello.
Lots of options there. So... Lee Stockwell, we're so happy to have had you on the show just to give a peek into what it's like, the life of being, you know, life after separation. In many people, I'm sure you didn't imagine this was where you were going when you made those vows, but here you are and living successfully, one would say.
I would hope so, yeah.
Well, from this point, this vantage point.
Yeah.
Yes. And anybody have any closing questions before we...
I kind of wanted to just touch on something that we haven't really talked about at all, and that's how... I have a minute, right, to do that? Yep. You know, whenever anything like marriage or divorce happens, or becoming a parent or anything like that, you're stepping into a new title, a new role, or out of an old title, like wife, husband, you know, mother, father. These are like, when you adopt a new role in life or a new title like that, it becomes a part of how you self-identify. And when you're stepping out of a relationship through divorce, you are shedding a title that maybe meant a lot to you at first. And so I just kind of wanted to, I think, name that transition that happens through divorce. And, you know, I think anybody listening to this and maybe anybody with any heart at all just knows, like, the advice I'm about to give, which is take it easy on yourself, you know, while you're going through all this.
Like, absolutely.
Be kind to yourself, because there's a lot, you know, going on as you shed roles and adopt new titles like single.
Right.
You know? I mean, that's huge.
Right, absolutely. Right.
Just do the best you can do. That's all you can do.
Really single after you have kids. Just saying. So what, Lee, was one thing maybe like Emily's helping me to think of, what, you know, something out there that was supportive to you? Like, was it a friend? Was it a family member? Like, what was really one of the clutch things that was able to support you in this transition in your life?
In my marriage, I'd kind of distanced myself from a lot of my friends. So I didn't have a lot of friends to kind of lean on in that time period. So what really helped me was a men's group with the marriage and family therapist. So there's a group of men that had been in kind of similar situations, and we could, you know, get together once a week and talk and kind of share our experience from, you know, the divorce and from that week, and, you know, things that have happened to us, and just get kind of a sympathetic ear, you know, some people who seem to, you know, relate and care about our situation at that point in time. And I think that helped a lot to get me through that. And then, you know, to move forward and do my work on myself with other programs, you know, moving out of the counseling arena into other more, you know, advanced kind of self-help arenas to try to, you know, improve myself, you know, get to the place that where I wanted, I was the person I really wanted to be.
Absolutely. So that's an important thing that I'm glad that you mentioned for anybody that's listening that may be in a similar situation, is that there are communities, groups, gatherings out there specifically for people that are going through similar situations. So if you find yourself in that and you don't have somebody to talk to and you can't call up a family member, there's, you know, you can Google it. I'm sure there's ways to get connected with people that are going through similar situations that you don't necessarily have to see at a Thanksgiving dinner, or you won't have to run right. into at the grocery right. store. So you can just be able, yeah, professionals right. and also just people that are sharing that similar experience but in a totally different life setting than you are. So you don't necessarily have to go that alone. And I think from my own personal experience with totally different things, that having that reflection from people that are going through a similar thing can be really beneficial, because it helps you realize you're not alone. You're not the only one that's struggling, or maybe your struggle is going to help somebody else out. So,
and vice versa.
Right.
Some, you can learn a lot from other people going through the same thing or similar thing that you're going through, right?
Very true.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So before we move on and let Ecotopia on, we're going to close out with a nice song. We got Ecotopia coming up with Steve and Susan Chudy, and they are going to discuss environmental issues with nationally renowned authors and activists. EcoTalk, it's your local link to a global network of folks who know and care about the health of our planet. Josh, would you like to introduce a song for us?
I was just going to say, this is a little disclaimer, because love is not a fool's game, but this is a great song.
Awesome. So,
take it away, Bonnie Raitt.
Get caught playing a damn fool game. Bad mistake is a crying shame.